All right. Well, thank you so much for inviting me last moment, Thomas. It was really kind of you. It's too bad that somebody had to end up in the hospital that I can stand here and tell you about my work, but I appreciate the opportunity nonetheless. Okay, moving along. So I'm going to be talking about drag in dense granular media and also swimming in granular media. This is work I've done at Emory University with two undergraduates, Matt and Tristan. And this is actually a very new project. We've just been doing this basically for about a month or so. So anyway, there's going to be a two-part talk. There's going to be a talk which I would consider the fun part, which might be fun because you know, it's the afternoon and people are just recovering from caffeine and such. And then there's going to be the more physics-y part. And I think I'm going to start with the fun part first, okay, which is the swimming part. How does one swim in granular media? Okay, and well, what is the motivation for understanding what drag is like in dense granular media? Well, of course, there's a lot of civil engineering I don't need to preach to you, or highways, or foundations set into granular soils, landslides and such. But there's also the issue of self-propulsion in granular media. In particular, just very recently, there was a fun issue or excitement on Mars where the Opportunity rover got stuck in a dune. And so NASA was very worried about this. And I think that the reason that they got stuck is that they're not really thinking of swimming through granular media. They're trying to sort of they're thinking of driving on highways and such like that, and they've got these wheels. And I think as if one wants to explore, say, certain kinds of granular media which are extremely loose, using wheels, four-wheel drive and such, becomes worse and worse of an idea. And if one wants to explore exotic places like on Mars, then one might actually consider using different ways of propulsion and self-propulsion through granular media. Okay. So so let me start off with with Purcell's swimmer. And the idea was, can one understand self-propulsion at low Reynolds numbers in fluids? And well, of course, this happens all the time. You have flagellated swimmers, right? It's a couple of microns long swimmers. And what's the easiest way to approximate this, to create a toy model for this? And one way is just to think of a model that has moving hinges. So you can have a single-hinged model and a two-hinged model, right? Something with a hinge that opens and closes and something that actually has two hinges that can open and close. And it turns out, this is what Purcell considered, that the simplest or the least number of hinges that possibly could produce propulsion, locomotion, is two hinges, and that's because of the time reversibility of Stokes flows, okay? And so he wrote a paper on this, and he talks about this swimmer. And then about 2 years ago, Leif Becker, Howard Stone, and I, we actually wrote a follow-up paper to Purcell's original paper, where we discuss which way this thing will swim. And actually, it's kind of interesting. It turns out that this thing will swim either to the left or to the right, and this depends upon the stroking angles. In other words, how large these stroking angles are. So if you have small stroking angles, it'll swim in one direction. I'm not going to go into the details. Large stroking angles, it'll swim exactly in the opposite direction. Okay. So all of this Purcell swimmer is based upon a simplification of Stokes' equations. Actually, to solve the problem of Purcell swimmer, this toy model, you don't want to deal with the full hydrodynamics. What you want to do is you want to actually work with slender rod or slender body approximations, something that makes matters much more tractable. And these slender body approximations allow you to determine what the force is, say, in the tangential direction, which is the force tangential to this cylinder, say, as a function of what the velocity in the tangential direction is. And then there's also a force if the cylinder is moving normally or perpendicular to its surface. And it turns out that the only reason that this thing can swim is that the force in the tangential direction, in other words, the tangential velocity, is half, you see this prefactor right here, half of the force in the perpendicular direction. Okay, so you've got this anisotropy. So this object, if it's moving like this, requires twice as much force as to slide or to move upwards, right? And the fact that this thing wags, you get twice as much force from the wagging or from the rotation, which will eventually result in the propulsion. Okay, so the idea is, well, we don't really even know what the equivalent of Stokes' equations are in granular media, but perhaps experimentally, one can come up with some sort of a slender body theory for granular media, and then actually apply this to something useful, for example, to say swimming, or to say, putting a post in a soil and trying to withdraw that post from the soil, right? Something useful like that. And so that's the theme of my talk. What I'm showing you here is the hydrodynamic simulations. And as I told you earlier, depending on the opening angle, you see that this one right here, for example, has a large, the large rotating angle, right? It almost is rotating 2 pi. Actually, it's 11 pi over 6, so it's almost 360 degrees. This one has a very shallow sweeping angle, very shallow rotation angle. And you can see that the purple one is already significantly moved to the right. The black one has just barely moved a little bit to the left. And then if you have some sweeping angle, which is somewhere between this shallow angle of 2 pi over 3 and almost total of 2 pi, in other words, this one right here, whatever that number is, 4 pi over 3, this one is hardly moving at all. Yes, Fred?
Is it all done with the local drag
approach? Yes, it's all done with the slender body theory.
What about the
hydrodynamic? Yes, well, that's a good question. We kind of argue that away. I mean, but yes, it's a higher order effect. Yeah, yeah. So as this angle, as these get closer and closer, this becomes a problem. But these are slender rods, so you know, we can argue about that. But the point is that this Purcell swimmer can actually move in either direction, to your left or to your right, depending upon what the stroking angle is. And the way you do this calculation is you don't use Stokes' equations. That's very difficult to do this, but use slender body theory to calculate this. And this was actually developed by Taylor, I think about 30 years ago. Okay, so now let's talk about the science, Mars science right here. And so not too long ago, the Opportunity rover got stuck. And so it got stuck, and then immediately the JPL people in LA, they started doing a mock-up. And you can see what the problem is. The problem is that the wheels got all gummed up, right? That you have all this fine granular matter stuck in the wheels, and that they have no more treads left on them. And actually what I can show you, which is kind of fun, is a movie of what's going on. So you see here that this wheel, this is actually time-lapse photography. This wheel is not spinning nearly as fast as it is here. I think the wheel was spinning maybe on the order of, say, a millimeter a second or something like that, linear velocity. But you see that this thing really has a huge traction problem. That is just churning through this dune that it got stuck in, and it's barely making progress. And again, you know, this is a very loose granular media where using conventional driving techniques, you know, like a four-wheel drive and such, just don't work that well. That was the real thing. That was the real thing. And I could have shown you the left wheel, the right wheel and stuff, but you just see it's churning and churning. It's not making any progress. And it took it about, I think, who knows, I think 3 weeks or so of very slow rotation of the wheels to actually move and get out of this mess, out of this quagmire. Yeah, it says, you know, be very, very, very patient, right? It took them weeks to move this thing out. Okay, so what I'm showing you now is the undergraduates project. And here, what we have here is we have basically a plexiglass boat or surfboard or something like that. And there's two motors. You can see that, so this is the correct view, and this is when you flip it upside down. And I flipped it upside down so you can see what's happening, that these motors are flapping, very much like Purcell's arms, Purcell's swimmer's arms were flapping. And you see that this thing is actually moving a very small amount to the right, just as the hydrodynamic or the slender body theory predicted for Stokes' equations, right? And it's moving a slight amount to the right. It's moving in the direction of this arrow. And it's also moving considerably up and down. Okay, and so the top speed that we were able to produce with this kind of a setup is about a millimeter per second. The Mars rover can do about a third of a mile per hour, which is about 100 times faster than this still. but Mars rover is also not setting any speed records at all, especially when it gets stuck in these sand dunes. Okay, so now there's possible to use different swimming strategies, and so far this is the fastest one that Matt was able to produce. So this one goes about a whopping 4.5 millimeters per cycle, a cycle being one of these flapping motions. And you see that this one already is just about to, you know, sort of cross this fake finish line, whereas this one is still much closer to the starting line. And so these things are swimming through the sand. And then the next thing that is kind of humorous is, well, what happens when one of these swimmers hits the side walls? And, well, you can see, if we're just a little bit patient, you'll see that something rather funny happens. First, this one right here seems to be very attracted to the sidewall, so he keeps bumping into the sidewall on the left, and it gets worse and worse, and you see that right there, that's the reflection of the fluorescent lights, the room lights, so this thing is starting to tip every time, and it's not actually going to completely tip over in this movie, but it will just flip itself on its side. So if it bumps into the sidewall, it likes to keep bumping into the sidewall, and it flips itself on the side. This one right here is trying to climb out of the box, so you can see, maybe you can see from the parallax of these rods that the rods are starting to tilt like this, right? And that's because this one is trying to climb up. So it's basically, it's digging out a hole here, and it's trying to climb out of the box. Okay, so the next thing I asked Matt to do was to try to figure out if he can get this thing to turn, right? It's kind of nice that it goes straight, perhaps very slowly, but it's only really useful once we can make a turn and do things like that. And sure enough, he figured out a swimming strategy to make a turn, and you see that here, these joints only make 90-degree rotations, not the full 180 sweeps, not a symmetric sweep. Okay, so this asymmetry, well, what does that result in? That does result in a turn. You can see that this thing is slowly rotating, well, not rotates back, but it's going to rotate forward. And so if you track this as a function of time, this is about a 2-minute experiment, we get about 20 or so degrees of rotation out of this asymmetric swimming sequence. Okay, and then what we can do is we can make some more comparisons with hydrodynamics. I mean, it's quite interesting that Purcell swimmer, our version of Purcell swimmer, behaves the same way in granular media as the simulations, and some experiments actually also bear out the simulations, behaves in the same way as hydrodynamics, as fluid dynamics. And what we're looking at here is we're looking at the position of the middle of this swimmer in XY space, so the path it traces out. You see it traces out an up-down path. So it moves up and down quite a bit, and it has a translation to the right. And what I'm showing you here is the analog in fluid dynamics, where you see that fluid dynamics, for the small stroking angle, it moves up and down a little bit, right? And for large stroking angles, it really moves up and down considerably. So I'm not saying that the paths look similar or extremely similar, but there are some similarities, that there's a lot of up and down motion, or side-to-side motion, and a little bit of directed motion in the direction you want to move in. Good. So now, well, what is this all based upon? This is all based upon understanding what granular drag is, right? If we can understand what the drag is due to one of these paddles moving, or what the forces imparted due to one of these paddles moving is, then we can start trying to predict and perhaps even develop more efficient swimmers and swimming strategies. So this is where I would say the more hardcore physics comes in. And so these are experiments that Peter Schiffer and his students, Albert and Barbossi, not a student, but colleagues, did at Notre Dame a number of years ago. And what they did was they put intruders, or simple geometrical shapes like cylinders and like spheres, and they dragged these things through granular media, dense granular media, measured the forces on those. So that's what I'm going to tell you about right now. An effort to try to come up with an analogy to slender body theory, in other words, to a theory that will describe what the force is on an object, depending on the orientation of the object, the direction you're moving, and other granular things of interest, such as the immersion depth, how deep that thing is buried underneath the sand, right? And, or the granular media, what kind of granular media are you using, etc. So these are experiments that I've done. This is right here, I'm measuring what the force is due to pushing a sphere into granular media. And you see that the force increases with depth, right? This is the force as a function of depth. And this is for granular media varying in, what, over a decade in size, all the way from 5 millimeters to 0.2 millimeters. And the interesting thing is that for these different size granular media, that the plunging forces are hardly affected. I vary this thing by over a decade, and you see that the forces, well, they do fluctuate as one would expect in granular media. Tom Halsey said a couple of days ago, even a factor of 10 is a little bit too much for granular media, but I'm within a factor of 2, I would say. So I think Tom would be, would you be happy with that? Factor 2, it's okay? Okay, barely okay. So factors of 2, we're not going to worry about, and within factors of 2, all these things lie on top of each other. And so I've got four curves here, four families of curves. This is the largest intruder, which I believe is an inch. Then we have half an inch, quarter of an inch, and an eighth of an inch. And you see as the intruder size decreases relative to the size of the granular media, the noise increases tremendously, which is also not unexpected. But one can take all of these curves and collapse them on top of each other. The collapse, I would say, is good for about 2 to 3 decades. So I'm collapsing the force by the only natural force scale, which is rho gv, right? V being the volume of the sphere, rho g being what you would expect. And then the depth actually here, this is, the depth is rescaled by the diameter, okay? It's rescaled by the diameter of this intruding object. This is actually a slight typo. The interesting thing is that this is not a linear behavior. In comparison, you can see that this is what linear behavior would predict, and you see that this line is off, it's superlinear, and the exponent is about 1.2. Now, the reason for that, I have no idea. Exponent of 1, one could probably explain. Okay, and here, what I'm plotting here is I'm plotting the force, again, as a function of the renormalized immersion depth. This is the depth divided by the diameter of a horizontal rod. Excuse the typo. This is horizontal rod that's being plunged in. That's this force, and then the withdrawal force is an F minus, is right here. So you see that the plunging force is somewhat larger than the withdrawing force. The plunging force has a shallower slope. The withdrawing force has a larger slope. But nonetheless, these things do collapse quite nicely over about 2 or so decades, and within a factor of 2. You've got a scatter of within a factor of 2 for all of this. So what these plots show you is that granular drag is anisotropic. In other words, plunging in, moving an intruder into granular media requires considerably more force than withdrawing this object from the granular medium. So direction matters tremendously. Up and down is very different. Also, the prefactors are quite different. For plunging, the prefactors are of order 10. For withdrawing, the prefactor is about 100 times less. The exponent here is different from the exponents there, z being the immersion depth, right? And then if one was to take this intruder and move it in the horizontal direction, you get linear behavior. That's what Peter Schiffer saw. And the prefactor is about order 1. Okay. So all of this together, I think, strongly suggests that we should be able to construct an equivalent of slender body theory, some sort of a drag tensor for objects, simple objects such as spheres or cylinders moving through granular media. Okay, so there's more slender body drag results. If one was to take a cylinder, horizontal cylinder, and drag it horizontally, you get this kind of behavior. This is this exponent z to the second makes quite a bit of sense. But then there's also lift that occurs. If you take a cylinder like this and you drag it through, there will actually be lift due to the dilation of granular media as it's being sheared. So that's interesting. Yeah? And no, it's actually sticking out. It's sticking out some. Yes, yes. Yeah, that makes a huge difference, of course, yeah. And then if one takes the cylinder and withdraws it or plunges it into the granular media, you see actually very similar behavior to what the sphere was doing. Okay. almost identical behavior to the drag forces for the sphere. Okay, now there's many other orientations to this slender body, and here I'm showing you another one. What if the slender body is horizontally oriented, and if one was to either move this up or down, or slide it in the horizontal direction, and you see that you get different drag forces. In particular, let me call your attention to this. If I was to take a slender body, such as a cylinder, and drag it horizontally, there's again a lift force that results. Okay, and so these are all approximate and order estimates. I don't even know if this has to be a power law behavior a priori. It just seems to collapse quite nicely using power laws. All right, so finally, I've also performed other experiments. This one actually is a little bit more relevant to the swimmer I showed you, because the swimmer actually is a rectangle that's been little rectangular flappy arms that have been inserted into the sand. So one can also experimentally measure what these drag forces are and also what the lift forces are. And I guess I'm also running out of time, which is a good thing because I'm at the end of my talk. So granular drag, well, there's quite a bit of differences between granular drag and hydrodynamic drag. One large difference is that it depends upon immersion depth, whereas in hydrodynamics, of course, nobody worries about immersion depth. Also, gravity plays a tremendous role, whether you're moving downwards or upwards, or what the orientation of the intruding object is relative to the direction of gravity. I didn't mention this in the talk, but obviously the type of medium makes a big difference, whether you're using glass beads, which is what I've been showing you, or if one uses sand or some sort of polycrystalline material, some sort of rough material. The interesting thing is that the results, for the most part, seem to be independent of the bead size. Some of the first data I showed you, these plunging spheres were actually smaller than the beads that they were plunging into. The data was very noisy. It had a lot of granular noise, but nonetheless, it fell on top of all the collapse data. Fell on top of the small beads, large objects with small beads. So this is very interesting. It doesn't depend upon bead size, and also this is something that Peter Schiffer points out in his work. And then it's also independent of velocity, whereas we know that hydrodynamic drag, of course, depends linearly, at least in Stokes situations, low Reynolds numbers, depends linearly on the velocity. Okay, so, and that's the end of my talk. Right. Stokes slits or something, yeah. Yes, I actually tried to do that experiment with limited success, but yes, I actually tried, you know, doing this in a grounding medium and trying to, yeah. So that would be very interesting. But the interesting point is that I do see power law behavior, which sometimes is linear. For horizontal motion, it seems to be linear. But for vertical motion, I get these funny exponents, 1.3 for plunging fairly consistently, regardless of whether I use cubes or cylinders and stuff, and 1.7 for going up. So I actually have another question for you, Fred. Maybe you can answer this. Do you think it would even be possible to describe granular drag in terms of a drag tensor, as one does for slender body theory? In other words, you add up various drag components, and then that's what the net drag is due to some complicated motion. But I have the.
locally linear, right? Yeah. But it's going to change over the course of this point.
So the consensus is it's hopeless to think of a tensor, a drag tensor, like one does for slender body theory. I'd like to try that, yeah. Yeah. So I can answer some of these questions. Not I can't do every granular medium. So this is glass beads, and if I submerge these in water, so to make them neutrally, you know, a little bit more buoyant, to decrease the effective density, right, by about half, I get the same scaling, including the prefactors. If I tap it, well, yeah, I don't do any tapping in my experiments, but my experiments, I'm continually shearing the system. Maybe, I mean, so other people have done experiments. Hovart, for example, has done experiments where he measures the force required to dislodge or overcome the yield stress as a function of number of taps on the system. But that's a different experiment. One can do this.
Let me go to the next comment, which is, if you plunge, you're disturbing whatever force that, disturbing and creating a force that
yes.
at the same time. If you would actually tap, you would reestablish, so when you pull out now, you're actually working in a direction in which the system is out of stress. And if you had tapped, after you had plunged, I suspect you would get a different answer.
Well, I would say actually that even in water, the Purcell swimmer is not very efficient. I'm not arguing with anything you're saying. Yes, I'm sure that there's many, this is the about 1 month of undergraduate work that's been done, but yeah. So one can probably come up with much more efficient ways of swimming, which doesn't involve wheels, which get, you know, buried in loose media and such, yes. Yes. Well, yeah, I mean, there are yeah, I mean, so what can I say about that, Doug? I don't have anything terribly insightful. Yes, I know a little bit about sidewinders, and I do know that there are some animals that basically burrow, you know, like this through sand rather than actually using an undulatory motion. So more of a mining type strategy than a swimming type strategy. But I've asked biologists this question. I haven't gotten, at least the ones I've asked, didn't give me any good answers. Yeah. Some rapids involving inertia somehow is what you're saying. I haven't thought about that. I don't have any idea for how to do that. That there's an analogy where one actually goes to because swimming at high Reynolds number certainly is much more efficient than swimming at low Reynolds number.
So study work and see more or less the story demonstration to kind of work how to try to tie into the different types.
Well, let me just add something to that. One fun thing to do, especially I think undergraduates would like doing this, is trying to figure out using maybe artificial intelligence optimal swimming strategies. So this might be a fun undergraduate competition or project to actually have artificial intelligence figure out what the flapping does, and since we don't have any theory for it anyway, and play with that. We tried a symmetric motion, so we tried this, which I think is close enough to a single hinge. And it will move a slight amount, but I think what's really happening is that it's just rearranging the granular media about it, rather than actually a directed swimming motion. Yeah. So I mean, it does move back and forth, and it might just very slightly do this. One thing we did try, which is kind of fun, we actually tried to have this thing swim over a mountain. We dug a mountain, and it turns out that it had a really time, probably harder time than even opportunity getting over this mountain. But it did manage finally to get over the mountain and just slithered down the other side to make up in speed lost. Yeah. Yeah.
So maybe we should open the floor at this point to questions on the whole afternoon session. We have a little talk about that.